Blog Talk Radio.
Stroll through the pictures, what I've left behind. It once again I'm locked up in memories, they all intertwine. The memories in my mind. I know tomorrow, 'cause that dawn will come. You will never know just what you have done.
Hello, world. This is Pamela Elaine Lockridge, your host for the Stop Child Abuse Now radio show, sponsored by the National Association of Adult Survivors of Child Abuse. This is scan number 2678, scan number 2678. And I'd like to talk to you before we bring our special guest on. I'd like to talk to you about NASCA and tell you about our mission. We're all about child abuse trauma prevention, intervention, and recovery. And we have a single purpose at NASCA to address issues related to childhood abuse and trauma, including sexual assault, violent or physical abuse, emotional traumas, and neglect. And we do so with two goals in mind. Number one, educating the public, especially as related to helping society get over its taboo of discussing childhood sexual abuse, presenting facts showing child abuse to be a pandemic, worldwide problem that affects everyone. And number two, offering hope and healing through numerous paths, providing many services to adult survivors of child abuse and information for anyone interested in the many issues involving prevention, intervention, and recovery. And our website is NAASCA.org, the National Association of Adult Survivors of Child Abuse. And I ask that you look at our website and look through the many different aspects of it, our program. Just go to the drop boxes along the front of the page, and you will see what all our programs are. So I'm going to bring on our special guest tonight. Wednesday's our special guest night, Jane Epstein. She's from San Mateo, California, and she has a story to tell about her abuse. And I'll tell just a little bit briefly before she starts and I bring her on. Her father was a public school psychologist. Her mother was an elementary school teacher. She had two older brothers. One was 4 years older, the other 6 years older. And she said her sexual abuse began when she was 6 years old by her older brother. So before I bring her on, I just want to go down and tell everybody we have some panelists tonight, Doug from Maryland and Liz from Illinois. So we welcome our panel guests, and we will get to them for comments and questions as we get into Jane's story a little bit. Jane, welcome. You're on with Mark, and I'm the host, and Mark is a co-host, and your mic is open.
Great. Thank you so much for having me. I'm well. How is everybody else?
I'm doing well.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, because when you come on and share your story, it not only helps others, but hopefully it will empower you and give you a voice Have you ever told your story on the radio before?
I have not given it on the radio, but I have given a few podcasts, and I was actually kind of reflecting this afternoon as I was walking the dog preparing for this, because I was recalling the first time that I gave a podcast, and it actually wasn't that long ago, and thinking how scary it was and how far I've come that I can talk about it a little more easier.
Right, and every time we tell our story, we do feel the visceral effects, even though, you know, we think we've come a long way just talking about it, you know, brings emotions. It brings, because we're human, you know,
yeah.
And that's why we feel. Right. So let's
I definitely still get emotional and feel exposed.
Right. So let's start chronologically and talk about your parents a little bit. And I don't think there was any emotional, physical, or neglect by your parents or mother. But talk about them a little bit.
Sure. I want to start with my parents. They, as I stated, my father was a school psychologist. My mom was a school teacher. And they had two boys, and they were content. And at one point, my mom held a little baby girl of a cousin, one of my cousins. And she decided she really wanted a third child, and she was really hoping for a baby girl. So she set out and told my father that she really wanted a third, and he was not going for it. But my mom was very determined, and she ended up getting pregnant. And so 5 months later, she was standing next to a couple, and my father was standing there, and her stomach was, you know, bulging out, not much because she was a tiny pregnant woman. And he said, yeah, you know, I didn't plan on having a third, but here we are. And so he didn't want the third, and then when the third came along, me, a baby girl, he really wasn't sure how to connect with me. And I do think part of that was his upbringing with his father. So that's kind of how my beginning started, and I never really connected with him. I do believe that he did the best he could with what he had, though.
Right. Did he have any sisters?
He did have sisters, yes, two younger sisters. But apparently his father passed away before I was born, and apparently he was pretty tough on the family.
Oh, okay.
And I will share this about my father as well, that he was very involved as a school psychologist, and he's deceased now, and he never knew about the sexual abuse, but he was very busy at school, and when I read his memoir, he talks about all the children that he saved at his school from sexual abuse and from alcoholic parents, and there's a lot of patting on the back there, and yet this was happening at home, and he wasn't aware of it. And I'm not going to lie, he is deceased, and when he died, I kind of didn't have any feeling. I didn't really have a connection with him. So there's probably some unresolved anger or things going on there.
So you never had a conversation with him about it?
I did not. He passed away before the memories came back.
Now, go ahead and start and tell us about the abuse itself and when it started and how it started, what happened.
Sure.
And who?
I'll do the best I can because I think like many survivors, I have segments of memory, and I do have a unique situation where I actually do speak with my brother, and there have been times I've had to ask him, you know, I'm having this memory, is this accurate, did this happen, and he will answer my questions. So that's kind of unique. I recall I know I was about 6 years old because I know what grade I was in. I was in second grade. And I have this little recollection of I was playing in the basement. I loved playing with Legos. I loved playing with my dollhouse. And somehow I ended up in his room. His room was in the basement. And he loved collecting bugs. And so I remember the bugs in the jars, the bugs in the cases, and I remember the red carpet. And I just recall kind of floating up to the ceiling. And the best way I can describe it is I felt like a science project. I felt that maybe I'd been poked and prodded and was confused. I wasn't, I didn't hurt, he didn't threaten me. I just remember feeling, what was that about? And it did continue on and off for 6 years. And at some point, I recall we were somewhere in the house, and I recall someone coming home, and we both raced to get dressed again. And so I think at some point, my body liked the touch. My body liked the attention. And I feel in my mind, I told myself that I was a willing participant, though we all know at 6 years old, you're not really a willing participant. My body just responded the way it was supposed to respond, and that got confusing for me because it's like, feels good, but yet I know something's not right. But I hadn't been educated about body safety, so I would not have had the words to tell anybody about it. Yeah, I do know, according to my brother, he said at one point I asked my mom, and he thought he was going to get in trouble, and she said, oh, you know, kids will be curious. She has no recollection of that conversation. I have a very open dialogue with most of my family about this situation because they all know I've gone very public about it. I don't know if you want to know more about the sexual abuse itself or not, but.
Well, only if you feel comfortable talking about it. I don't know what a 12-year-old can, you know, do. I don't know.
Sure.
With a six-year-old.
Right. Well, I will say that, you know, I've asked him. I said, you know, why did you do this? Were you sexually abused? And he said, no, he was not sexually abused. He said it really started out as curiosity when he was 12. And he shared the story with me, and I'll share it with you how the whole thing really started. You know, I had two older siblings, and the three of us were in my bedroom watching a TV, a little black and white TV. Parents were in the kitchen cleaning at dinner. And my mom called down the hallway, and she said, hey, kids, it's time to get ready for bed. Well, I was a six-year-old little girl. I did what I'd been doing for my first 6 years of my life. I hopped out of bed, and I got dressed into my nightgown. My brother had entered puberty at some point, being a 12-year-old boy, and when I did that, he said he saw me, and he just knew he needed to know more, and he made a conscious decision to get me alone and I suppose poke and prod me and figure it out. And when he did that, he said his body reacted like a 12-year-old's body would react, and his body wanted more. So he started volunteering to babysit me. He would speak in my room at night when he thought I was asleep. And this did continue off and on for 6 years. There came a point when he was away at college for a little bit, and because of all this activity, I was actually hypersexual, and my body was craving that sexual touch. There was never any intercourse, thank goodness, but it was still very damaging. But my body was craving that. And when he went away to college, the best way I could describe it is, you know, I felt like I was a crack addict and I needed to get my fix. So when he came back home, I actually went down and I sought him out. And that's been really hard for me to admit. And that was a big hurdle in my healing process, that and admitting the fact that the touch did feel good.
Yeah, that's hurt often, you know, getting, you know, it's really trauma bonding. I don't know if you've heard that term.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Have you heard the term trauma bonding?
I have heard the term trauma bonding, yes.
It has to do with chemicals, has to do with
mm-hmm.
hormones, and that's what children have. They have hormones going on that they don't know how to react to. And, you know, statistics show that males, 14-year-old males or 12 to 14-year-old males start becoming curious when they have female siblings. And this
right.
is not abnormal. I mean, it's abnormal to do it and allow it to happen, but it's not it's not unheard of, right? And a lot of it is going on in families, and a lot of the families are hushing it up instead of talking mm-hmm. about it. Okay.
Right, which is a huge problem.
I think they
problem.
End up going to therapy. Exactly. They say, you know, our family can't, this can't be, you know, told to anybody because our family, we would lose our family status. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But yeah.
Well, and it can,
I'm sure you, go ahead.
It can definitely tear a family apart. And I've done a lot of homework on this, and I understand that, you know, boys, probably these days, 10 to 14, we really need to educate our boys and talk to them about curiosity and touching, because they are curious, and they if they have a younger sibling, the younger sibling is safe and the younger sibling is available to them. You know, I was on this call with Brad Watts yesterday. He just recently wrote a book called Sibling Sexual Abuse, and he actually counsels the perpetrators. And he really expressed it really well for us, in that, you know, if you are a 12 or 14-year-old boy and you're feeling those hormones and you're curious, you're going to go downstairs to your little sister because she's there. She's available. Or your little brother. They're there. They're available. Instead of going to school and touching a girl. So they're readily available, and families do feel a lot of shame about this. But according to the statistics, it's happening a lot, and by shutting it under the rug, it creates more problems. And if we could just address it and get everybody in the family help and counseling and quit shoving it under the rug, maybe we could make a difference. Because I do know that I can state for myself, I didn't realize I was sexually abused. I thought all those years it was just two kids being curious. But it turns out it was actually very damaging.
Yes, absolutely. We have a pretty large panel. Would you mind breaking at this point and going to the panel?
Sure.
Okay. I'm going to bring on Mark from Louisiana. Mark, do you have any questions or comments?
Well, I was just going to make a comment about back when you were talking about how your father didn't have really any interaction with you. I can kind of relate to that. You know, my dad was always there. He provided, and we had a nice home, food, and clothing, but there was no real physical contact, no real talking contact. I mean, by physical, I mean just hugging and just holding and nurturing. There was none of it, and I can understand, you know, that can put a big void in your mindset and even kind of affect your thought process as you get older, you know. And I just wanted to comment that I understand where you're coming from with that.
Yeah, I'm sorry that happened to you, too. Yeah, it definitely made me more vulnerable to my brother, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think all small children need their dads. I think all small children need that father figure, you know, to be there. And when you don't have it, something's missing. And you don't know what it is because you're 4, 5, 6 years old. But then as you get older like we are now, we understand there was a void there and wish we could have it back, but we can't. So, you know, we go on.
Yeah, I did seek out a father figure later in life. I know we're going to stick with the panel here, but at some point I did become a stripper, and I met an older man. He was 11 years older than me, and I feel like he filled in a lot of the fatherly gaps for me, and he did pass away, and then I kind of transferred that onto my stepfather, and my stepfather kind of filled in those gaps, and at some point I got very healthy, and now I'm remarried, and I seem to have met those needs, but it definitely took me off course.
Right.
Well, thank you, Mark.
Yeah, thank you, Martin.
We're going to go down the panel. We're going to go down to Doug from Maryland. Doug, you're on.
Yes, I just want to say thank you for sharing your story. And I agree that, you know, boundaries are important. And, well, I'm sorry what you went through. Thank you for sharing your story.
Thank you for being here, Doug.
Thank you. And
thank you, Doug.
Yeah, I think that both, you know, children need to be taught, like I said, boundaries and discipline, and because they have to have, you know, you hit the middle school, high school years and start to have all the hormones, and you need to be sort of kept in check a bit.
Right. Right.
And this is a little triggering for me. Can I just share something about myself? Well,
absolutely.
It's just my father was one of those people who, trigger alert, wanted to relive all his adolescent fantasies through me. And it's like that was not healthy for me. Because my hormones were, of course, telling me all that stuff. And it would have been better if my father would say, no, discipline. Because at that age, the hormones are telling, you know, people what to do. And it's up to adult parental figures and teachers and to say, no, that's not okay. And, of course, someone at that age may not want to hear it, but, you know, it's what, but when they get older, they'll people will appreciate the fact that someone did their best to keep them out of trouble.
Yeah.
So, anyway.
Yeah, Doug, I appreciate you sharing that because I'm actually a mom of two boys, and they are 12 and 13, and very hormonal time. And now, today, there's pornography. So, you know, I'm trying to do the best I can. My husband's trying to do the best he can. And, you know, it's a lot for a boy. And so my husband and I, we try and check in with them often and let them know what's going on with their bodies and what's appropriate and what's not appropriate. And that's today. So when you and I were growing up, none of that was happening. So I'm really sorry that this is triggering, and I'm sorry that that happened to you.
Okay, thank you. And, well, all I'll say is I'm sure one day your children will thank you and your husband for doing their best to like keep them out of trouble and everything. And
yeah. Right now they roll their eyes at me.
Of course they do. And then, you know, when you're in their 20s and 30s, they'll be like, oh, no, mom and dad, you guys were right, and I was young and dumb and whatever. And so you guys still appreciate what you're doing for them now at some point. So,
well, thank you. I hope you're right.
Yeah. Okay.
Yep. We know from experience he's right. Thank you, Doug, so much.
Thank you.
All right. I'm going to go down to Elizabeth from Illinois.
I'm here.
Elizabeth, you're on with Jane. Hi, Elizabeth.
Jane.
Hi, Elizabeth.
Hi, honey. I'm a crime survivor myself, survivor with a testimony, SWAT team. I'm an American Native woman. I send my condolences to you for speaking out about childhood sexual abuse. Mark, myself to you too. All the survivors are on the panel right now. I send my condolences and my respect to all of you that you can now speak out. And hopefully in our future that as we work and have more on the panel, that we get a law passed in Congress that there's monies to be paid to ones that are victims of childhood sexual abuse. I feel that they become disabled, impaired, have done things in their life they regret and have repercussions of. I myself have had things and I've done things that I regret. But I'm here to support you as well as all the panel is here to support each individual, all of y'all. And may the great spirit be with you.
Thank you, Elizabeth.
What's up?
Thank you, Elizabeth. That's awesome. Okay, I'm going to bring Mary Ellen on from New York. Mary Ellen?
Hi, how are you?
Hi, Mary Ellen.
Nice. We're doing good, Mary Ellen.
Nice to join you. Thank you for being here, Jan. Thank you for sharing your story and being so open and honest with everything. And it's been really nice to hear the guys speak up and express some of their thoughts as well. So I want to thank them.
Yeah.
I'm glad to be here tonight, and I'm glad to be able to share this time with you. So I'll pass for now.
Well, thank you for being here for support. I appreciate it.
You're welcome.
Jane?
Yes.
Hey, I was muted and didn't realize it. I'm sorry.
Oh.
Okay.
I thought
yeah.
it was me.
No, it was me, the host. Shame on me. Anyway, I'll try to watch
okay.
that.
We've all done it this year
okay.
with Zoom, for sure.
yeah. So I was saying, you know, we can get back to your story and pick it up wherever you want to, but I wanted to remind you that you had said you were a child who desired sexual touch and had nowhere to get it. So you became obsessed with having boyfriends. Can you talk about that?
Sure. So shortly when my brother came home from college and I sought him out. He left and went back to college, and it was shortly after that time that my parents did get divorced. My mom and I moved out. It was about sixth or seventh grade, and I'm obsessed with boys. And my studies didn't really struggle. I was very flirtatious. I was very social, but I would describe myself as not really fully present or connected. But I wasn't aware of it. But looking back now, I can see that. And I just did anything for boys' attention, and I got in trouble for kissing on the playground. And as I progressed through high school, around 10th grade, I started really becoming very promiscuous and sleeping around a lot. And I started doing drugs, and I started drinking alcohol, and I started skipping class. I barely graduated from high school. And after that, my mom had said, okay, I really can't take this. I don't know where you are at night. This is my house, my rules. If you're not going to obey, then you're going to need to leave. At that point, I was actually ready to leave, and I moved out, and I was going to go to a business college. And I moved out, and I continued to party. I continued to sleep around. And I actually ended up getting – I slept with three men in 1 week, and I ended up getting pregnant. I didn't know who the father was. And I reached out to my mom, and I had made the decision that I was going to have an abortion, and I did have an abortion, and my mom could not make that decision for me, but she was as supportive as she could be, and she got me back into therapy. She got me to see the therapist that I'd seen when my parents were going through a divorce. And there was a missed sign here, because I sat down at a therapist's office, and I remember sitting down and thinking, oh, you know, the office hasn't changed much in the last 6 years. And, you know, therapist sits across from me. He's lost a little more hair. And his comment to me was, okay, I missed the scene here, but by this time I was also stripping. I'd become a stripper. And he sits across from me and knows that I'm pregnant and I don't know who the father is and I'm making my decision. And he says, you know, I think stripping's been good for you. It's kind of done for you what therapy couldn't do for you. You know, you're well spoken. You're not shy. So he really missed the mark on that, because if a young lady is sitting in your office pregnant, doesn't know who the father is, and she's stripping, there's probably something going on there. But he missed that sign. Yeah, so I became a stripper. And through stripping, I know it's common for sexual abuse victims, females, to become strippers. And I found it very empowering. I discovered that, oh, wait a second, maybe I am pretty. And I did learn how to have small talk with men in order to get their money. It was about the money. It was not about trying to get you to come home with me. It was about the money. All I saw was dollar signs and power and control. But then it started kind of changing, and I got tired of being groped, and I got tired of being mocked. You know, times that guys would, they would mock you and call you a whore and a slut. And I started craving, I was feeling like I was going to go down the slippery slope of alcohol and drugs in order to stay on that stage. But I didn't want to give it up because it was feeding my ego. And it was right around that time, in all honesty, where a gentleman came up and he tipped me, "What are you doing here? You look like the kind of girl I'd take home with me, my mom." I did have an innocent look about me. And I said to him, I said, "Look, will you hang out after? And I'd love to talk to you." And he said, "Sure." And he was 11 years older than me. And I recall him waiting at the bar, sipping his usual drink. And I raced back and I got dressed and I put on some fresh perfume, came back out and found him at the bar. And I crawled up to the bar stool right next to him. And at that moment, I just looked at him and something inside of me just knew that I needed this person in my life and that I was going to love him. I don't know if you want me to continue or not.
Yeah, go ahead and talk about that. Go ahead and talk about that.
Yeah, so he was 11 years older than me, and, you know, he made me laugh and asked me questions, and he did start kind of chasing me, and he would come to the bar, and we eventually started, I don't know if you call it dating or hooking up, but he really cared about me, and he said, "You know, I really can't stand it, seeing you on stage. I really hate it." He said, "I don't know what you're getting from it." And he said, "I really want you to quit, and I want you to move in with me, and I want you to go back to business college." And I struggled with that. I thought, by that point, I'd been used and dumped by so many men. I knew that if he hurt me, I just wouldn't be able to take it. I was terrified. I was terrified of losing him. I was terrified of loving him. but he did give me the ultimatum, and I eventually did quit dancing. And he did not understand why it was a struggle for me to make that decision, but I did make that decision. And my father did not want me to move in with him, but I ignored my father, and I loaded up my car, and I moved to Iowa, and I moved. He, as I said, he was 11 years older than me, and he really, he taught me how to socialize. He taught me how to cook. He taught me how to dress. He brought home business suits, and I was going to school, and he would help me study, and he really, he dressed me up. And the, you know, there was a little bit of inner stripper inside of me, but the memories had not come up yet. So I was willing to be molded into this human being, because I think I wanted to be somebody. I didn't know who I was. I didn't have a me because I was so disassociated. So yeah, he did mold me, and we got married, and it was not a perfect marriage because I loved him. I made him my world, which was a lot of pressure for him. But then the abuse, I think, started. Sexual abuse in the back of my mind, I think it started kicking in because I actually tried to sabotage that marriage and tell him that he was controlling, when in reality, I don't think he was controlling. I think I was just feeling confined and scared and not worthy of love. I was
absolutely
really struggling.
That was
yeah.
The word I was thinking of.
Yeah.
You weren't feeling worth love. Yeah.
I was not feeling worthy, and, you know, so it was right around then that I was really starting to struggle, and maybe somewhere around there, he was having difficulty swallowing, and So I took him to the doctor, and they said it's normal for a man your age. We just put a balloon in. Your esophagus narrows. We just put a balloon in. We, you know, fix it. No big deal. And so I took him to the doctor, and the doctor comes out, and he said, well, we weren't able to do it because there's a mass in your esophagus, so we took a biopsy instead. And my heart sank. On some level, I knew this was serious. I knew it was bad. Turns out it was bad as esophageal cancer, 5% survival rate. But at that moment, I had quit going to church. I was raised in a Christian home, but I quit going to church. But when we got that diagnosis, I got very serious with God, which I think happens, and I surrendered. I said, God, I surrender this over to you, and I just sensed that I was getting ready to walk into some kind of storm. I didn't know what the storm was, but I just knew it was a storm and that God was going to have me, and I honestly wouldn't have it any other way. I got to take care of Mark like he had taken care of me when he rescued me from the stage. I got to take care of him and feed him and take care of his bandages and be there for him when he was growing up. And I was there the moment he died, and it was actually very, very beautiful. And something interesting happened when he died, and I realized, looking back, I realized that I was alive because I had so much pain and I could actually feel the pain that I was alive for the first time. And I actually felt joy. So by him dying, it helped begin the healing process. And I started having relationships and letting people in. So that might be a good time to pause.
Yeah. One question before we go down the panel. Did you ever talk to him about your sexual abuse? Did y'all have conversations about it, or was you not able to open up to him about that?
You know, at that time, I was still viewing it as, oh, it was just two kids being curious. It couldn't have messed me up that much.
Okay. All right.
But I will say somewhere in that period of time, my sibling had children, and I went to go meet the children, and my sibling called me aside, and he said, I want to apologize for what I did to you when you were little. And I was taken aback by it, and I responded with, it's okay, I participated. And I took that apology, and I put it in its little box, and I put everything right back away.
Wow. That's not unusual.
No.
Okay, let's go to Mark. See, I'm going to bring Mark on. Mark?
Well, I don't really have a question right now. I just was wondering, you know, your husband, you know, he took you in unconditionally. Is that what you were saying?
And
yeah. He loved you even though, you know, he knew what you were doing. And I think I applaud that. That's good. I think a lot of women who suffer child abuse need to find a man like that, and you know, to help them on their road to recovery and get stronger. So
yeah.
I
was very blessed.
That's what I wanted to say. I just wanted to applaud you for that. You found someone to help you get going and get recovered.
Well, thank you. You'll hear later in the story, I actually found another person to help me finish the recovery. Well, not finish. I'm still recovering. But, yeah, he definitely gave me a really good start.
Thank you, Mark. All right, we're going to Doug. Let's see. Doug? You're on with Jane.
I just want to say thank you for sharing your story. I really don't have much to add. So I'll just say thank you for sharing.
Well, thank you. Thank you for being here.
Thank you, Doug. Thank you, Doug. Okay, Elizabeth.
Jane?
Elizabeth?
Jane?
Yes.
I'd like to ask you a question.
For sure.
I'm listening to your story, your testimony. Do you today feel like you owe to your marriage because of what had happened to you in your childhood, that you're obligated to love your husband because of your childhood sex abuse?
My new husband?
Please?
Yeah, because I'm actually remarried. That's an interesting question. He's actually a really great guy, so, and he's been very supportive of my healing process. I have to be honest, I'm not quite sure how to answer that. I don't know that I feel obligated. I honestly don't know how to answer that. I'm sorry.
It's okay. I just have dealt with a lot of crime survivors, so I ask them these little questions because I'm a writer and I write things about crime survivors and suburban survivors' bill of rights. I just want to ask you that question, honey. Because I've had it happen to me. I felt like when I married my older husband, I felt like I obligated to him because of my childhood, and I experienced my childhood with him. I'm like, oh, and I didn't realize that was happening to me until it threw me in my face. It's like, okay, I'm married to you. I'm your wife. And he's passed on, but I'm your wife, but I feel like he gave me love that I had never felt, but whenever I was molested, it was an ugly feeling. But when he loved me, I felt unconditional love there. So it was like a trigger in my mind, and I felt like I was obligated to love him because I didn't want to lose him. I didn't want to feel alone. Mm-hmm. I didn't want to feel absent in the marriage.
Yeah, I can see that. And I mean, there's definitely, you know, I think being sexually abused creates boundary issues, and where do I begin? Where does he begin? Where do I end?
Right.
How do I say no? I think that I've gained a lot of clarity about that. Honestly, since I quit drinking alcohol, I've gotten a lot more clarity about who I am and what I feel. So you're asking me a question that I'm not sure I've actually considered. So I will
give
start
it some thought.
Actually considering that.
Give it some thought. It'll come to you in spirit and mind, body and soul and healing. I mean, because I've had that experience myself, and I'm 63 years old. You know, I remarried, but when I married my husband that was older, I had that feeling as a child, I felt like a young girl with him. I felt like I was just this little girl in my marriage with him. I was kiddish, acting like I was in my 60s, I was feeling like I was in my 15s. I was 15 years old, 14 years old. So that's why I asked you the question.
Yeah, great question. Thank you.
My pleasure.
Thank you, Elizabeth. That was some insight there, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Okay. I'm gonna go to Mary Ellen in New York, and then we'll go down to Darlene from Tennessee. Mary Ellen.
Yes. I thought that was a really beautiful segment that you just shared with us. And the way you went through it was so peaceful, and I really appreciate that you shared those moments because it was obviously life-changing for you. And part of what it brought to mind to me was when we go through trauma, we learn to mask our feelings, and when we do that, we lose good feelings and bad feelings.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, the negative or the positive are all shut down, and we don't know how to express them or whatever. But when we get to the point where something happens in our life that is so huge, like maybe the death of him or the caring of him, or as the sadness rises, so does the joy. And, found that very beautiful as you were telling it. It is so true, and it's hard to recognize when you haven't been in those spots, but I think for a trauma survivor, when they hit that spot where they begin to heal, and they recognize that instead of everything just being okay, you can be really happy.
Right.
As
right.
And things do make a switch. So
yeah.
I really appreciated the way you put that out there. So thank you for sharing it.
Well, thank you.
You're welcome.
Absolutely. Darlene? Hi, Darlene.
Hello. I'm so glad you're telling your story. It takes a lot of faith. Thank you so much. I just now came on. I just got to hear a little bit. So just listening in at the moment. Thank you.
Thank you, Darlene. Thanks for being here.
Yes. Thank you so much. All right. So let's do a short recap. Let's see. Your father, you and your father never really connected emotionally. Did you and your mother have a strong connection emotionally?
We did. We still do. We're very strongly connected. Yes.
Okay. And you, let's see, your older brother, he was 12. You were 6. He began abusing you. You really didn't know it was abuse. And then when he left, you needed that touch. And then when you got a little older, you had multiple boyfriends. And you became obsessed with having boyfriends. And then you went and became a stripper. I'm kind of rushing it. You became a stripper. Then you met your husband at the strip club. And he was a great husband, but he died of cancer. And that's when you started feeling alive. You started having feelings because of that big, that was a trauma in your life, just like your other trauma, but that was a different trauma, right?
Right.
So then you say you've been in and out of therapy, and you said your therapy started when your parents got divorced. How old were you when your parents got divorced?
I'm going to guess about 12 or 13. And that was just sporadic. That was my parents were just checking to make sure that I was okay. And then I was back in therapy when my mom and I started fighting. Yeah. But I'm pretty sure I put some therapist kids through college.
You're funny. So your parents got divorced. Did she remarry your mother? And where do you live
she
with
did.
Her?
I actually didn't live with her because she didn't get remarried until I was out of high school. So I never lived with my stepfather, but he was a great guy. He took me in. Yeah.
All right. So what happened between the years of when you, okay, so how old were you when you lost your first husband?
I was 34, and I was finding myself, my new self, because at that point then I had a job, I had a home, I was a professional, and I was feeling and I was building relationships with females and figuring out who I was. And at one point, I did start dating, and at one point I was alone, I wasn't dating, and I thought, I kind of like myself, I think I'm going to be okay. And it was probably a week later that I went to with another friend, and she introduced me to my husband. And when she introduced me, I didn't understand that he really likes to eat. So when she introduced me to him, he's looking at me, he's looking at food, he's looking at me, food. Then he offered me food. That was his way of getting around it. So we connected, and we dated for a little bit, and we got married. And he's actually only a year older than me. It felt like a different kind of relationship. I didn't need him in my life. I chose him. I decided I wanted to be married, and he didn't have any kids, and I didn't have any kids. And so we got married, and we had kids. We had kids back to back, two boys a year and a week apart. And that's kind of when the trouble began for me again. It started, my dad passed away, and I had to go back home, and I was in the basement with my two brothers, and I saw the bug boxes and that had been in my brother's room and in the basement and my dollhouse, and I just, something just didn't feel right. And it was kind of in the back of my mind. And then I went back home, and my husband and I, we went out to dinner with some friends, and they were talking about their teenage son, and they were talking about something, and I'm not going to go into the detail, but they were talking about something, and everybody at the table was laughing, and I was laughing. And then I stopped, and I thought, wait a second. There's something like that happened to me. And I didn't say a word to anybody. So this was all brewing, and then my husband and I, something in the bedroom happened, something intimately happened, and my eyes flung wide open. It was dark, and I thought, what the hell? What the hell was that? And the next morning I woke up, and I was just angry. A memory of my brother had been placed. That memory has never gone away. And I became volatile. I became depressed. And I really thought that I was depressed and volatile because my marriage wasn't perfect. And I thought I was angry that I'd lost my first husband. And I thought that I was angry because of hormones of having two children. I really, really believed that. And I, once again, tried to sabotage the marriage, went to a lawyer. I thought about getting an apartment. And I begged God. I said, God, I want out. I want out. And God said, no, I hate divorce. That's what I heard God say. And I said, okay, fine. Then you take the marriage. I surrendered the marriage over to him. And I told my husband, I said, we've got to go to counseling because I'm miserable. And I told my husband, I said, I want to die. I either want out or I want to die. That terrified him. A very logical, smart person, and this terrified him. It just didn't make sense. The mother has his two children. So we did go to counseling. We were in counseling for about 4 years. And the counselor couldn't fix him. I know, that's kind of a joke, but I was just like, what is going on? Why am I so unhappy? And the therapist finally said, Jane, you know, your anger is not matching what's going on. You know, your husband is trying. He's doing everything he can. It's just not matching. And I said to him, I said, well, you know, I was trying to turn over everything. And I said, well, there was, you know, my brother messed with me when I was little. And the room got really quiet. And the therapist leaned in and he said, what do you mean your brother messed with you when you were little? And I said, well, he sexually abused me. What went through my mind was, great. You know, my husband's sitting here, I'm confessing this, and now my husband's going to be like, oh, of course, all the marital problems are your fault. Instead, my husband leaned in, and he said, I'm really sorry that happened to you. And he was really beside himself. He was beside himself. He was angry at my brother. He was angry at my family. And he didn't barrage me with questions. He didn't tell me, oh, it was a long time ago. You should forgive. He didn't do any of that. And it was at that moment that I decided, okay, there's a reason that I'm unhappy. Maybe there's something to this sexual abuse. And that's when I quit drinking, and I started writing everything down. I started writing my story down, and that's when I was able to put the pieces together.
Wow. That's powerful.
So when would you say, what was the catalyst you would say got you on your real healing journey?
Was, you know, when the therapist, because the therapist, you know, I said to the therapist, it wasn't that big a deal, was it? I mean, kids are curious. And he said, not for 6 years. And I said, but, you know, it felt good. My body reacted. And he said, yes, that happens. It's an interesting dynamic. Your body reacts the way it's supposed to react. And he said, and then you can look at the rest of your life. It explains everything, why you were a stripper, why you don't feel worthy of love, why you're trying to push this husband away and trying to push your other husband away. He said, it all makes kind of sense. And so I came home and I made a conscious decision that I was going to quit drinking, and I started rewriting my story. And once I started writing it down, I thought, no wonder My life happened out of order. I should not have known about sex and the feelings of sex at age six. And then I was a widow at 34. It was all out of whack. And so I just continued to write. And as I wrote, I decided to start writing a memoir. And I would share it with my husband. I still couldn't speak it to him. I couldn't say what had happened, but I could write it and share the chapters with him. And as I started to do that, I was letting go of my secrets, because I have a lot of secrets from him. As I shed my secrets and as he got to read them and he understood me more, I think that's really where the healing began. And, I mean, 4 years ago, we would not have been able to, with COVID 4 years ago, we would not have been able to be under the same roof for a year. But now, with all this healing going on, we've been able to be under one roof for a year, and I think it's actually made our marriage stronger.
Wow. So you started understanding your whole life at that point, and that's a good point mm-hmm. you brought up about your life out of all of us survivors, our lives were out of order because, like you said, we never should have been sexual beings or known about sex before we were ready to, right?
Right.
That was pushed upon us without our consent, which is actual assault, right? It's actual
mm-hmm. right.
crime. It was an actual crime, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I'm thinking, we need to break again right here, but I'm loving your healing story. That is so fascinating. I'm loving it. You know, they say journaling is awesome. So I'm
yeah,
gonna go to Mark.
It's hard.
Oh, yeah, it's not easy. I mean, it's very hard, you know. Mark?
Yes. I want to disagree with what you said and Pam just said. A six-year-old girl, me, when you're introduced into the sexual world, however it was, in this case, your brother, but when you're introduced, your whole innocence of life was destroyed, was murdered. And, you know, like Pam said, you're not supposed to know that stuff at 6 years old. And here, you know, your whole world is shattered. In my opinion, it's not right. It happened, but you know, that's what causes all the problems that I guess all of the survivors have, you know, down through the years. But you know, I think that for people listening, you know, you got to be aware that young children aren't ready for adult things, and
mm-mm.
you know. You need to be vigilant of that and grow them up that way and protect them and help them. So, you know, I agree with what you guys just said that, no, young girls, that's just wrong. Your whole innocence, you know, you're supposed to be a little girl, you know, happy, playing with dolls, I guess, and all that and being innocent. But now you're introduced to this adult world, and you didn't want it. You didn't even know about it. But I'm glad
right.
that you came out of it. You I'm glad that you saw that and you are rising up out of it and are on the way. You know, that's good. And you're speaking. And like was said earlier, the more you speak, the better you feel inside yourself and better you're helping people who are listening. People who may very well have gone through the same thing you did and don't know how to say it or talk about it, but now that they hear, you know, that'll give them power, and you're breaking the cycle. Like you said, you had the two young boys. Now you broke the cycle, and they know that they didn't have that kind of life. So, you know, I applaud that for you, and I'm just wanted to comment like that. For that, you know, I'm glad that you're on your healing journey.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Mark. Let's see real quick. Doug, do you have anything right now?
Okay, I think Doug's just listening. Let's see, Mary Ellen. Mary Ellen.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't really have anything to add at this point, but I am still here and enjoying the conversation. Thank you.
Thank you, Mary Ellen. Yeah. Now we're going to get into her more into the healing side of it and about what she's doing as advocacy. But you said you went into a deep depression. Were you hospitalized, Jane?
I was not. I was on antidepressants. I was very fortunate that my husband was well employed and we had good health benefits because the insurance was not covering for the antidepressants. They're about $2,000 a month and lots of therapy bills. I know we put that guy's three kids through college. But no.
It said, let's see. You made a conscious decision to quit drinking. Were you, what was going on with alcohol in your life at that time?
Well, I forget which somebody made reference to it earlier. So I was, first of all, I live in California, and the wine, there's lots of wine here. And my husband drinks a tiny bit of wine each night. And I started with half a glass, and I went to a glass. And it kept increasing. And I was seeing our marriage counselor and my therapist, and he said to me, my therapist said, I'd like you to try and give up alcohol. Just try and give it up for 2 weeks. And I made it 9 days. And I was just craving it. And so then later, when I hit bottom, I thought, let me try that again. And I took it as a little challenge. I thought, well, let me give it up for 30 days. And I gave it up for 25 days. And at day 25, I was walking my dog, and I felt joy. And I could see the sunshine, and I could see the leaves on the trees. And I thought, maybe there's something to this. And so I thought, well, let me go for 60 days. Let me go for 90 days. And then the creativity started flowing, and I was less angry. I was less volatile. I wasn't as depressed. And I thought, maybe there's something to this. And I think it was, again, because I'm a survivor, to me, the numbing versus the not numbing was so clear. I know there's a lot of social drinkers out there, and they give up alcohol, and they'll say, well, I didn't notice the difference. For me, because I know that I was numbing pain, it was very different. And I wanted to keep going. And I will say that at a year point, I thought, oh, maybe I'll have a drink to celebrate, and I did not. So the year was kind of anticlimactic, and then I just keep sticking with it.
Wow, that's amazing. So you didn't really have a drinking problem. It was just more you wanted it, right?
I think close to a bottle a day. So I think it could have become a problem, but I say I wouldn't have been alcoholic, but maybe I was. We'll say my poor husband, because he stocked up on wine to keep me drinking, and then I quit drinking cold turkey and taking him 5 years to get through the wine.
So when you said at one point that you were doing drugs, did you ever come addicted to anything?
You know, I did not. I feel very fortunate. I did a lot of cocaine, and I'm fortunate to be alive because I did do acid mushrooms one night, and I drove home. I think somebody was looking out for me.
Absolutely, he was. So, says you're no longer in therapy. So what happened that you felt like you didn't need therapy anymore?
So once I started writing, the therapy actually kind of got in the way. It was taking time away from my writing, and I found the writing more helpful. And I was seeing a therapist, and a third therapist, and because I started, we were seeing the marriage counselor, I was seeing the psychiatrist for the prescription, and then I started seeing a female therapist. I mean, I was really searching for answers. And I was seeing her, and she was actually taking up my time away from my writing. And I explained to her that I was writing this, and that I was going to start a blog, and I was going to go public with my story. Said to me, I don't think that's a good idea because, you know, what if one of your kids' moms finds out and they talk to their kids and then your kids get teased? And I thought, that's not good advice. And there was something inside of me that just said, you have to write. You just have to write. And I found the writing to be more therapeutic. And as I started shedding my layers and sharing my story, my marriage was healing. So the therapy actually was getting in the way.
Right. Not all therapists are good therapists. I'm sure you found that out.
Correct. I did find that out. I think she was very long. I think that my story needs to be heard because there's a lot of sibling sexual abuse survivors out there.
That's right. Was she a trauma-focused therapist, or was she, what kind of therapist? I mean, nowadays you really have to find a sexual abuse child trauma.
Right. And I'm not sure that she... It seems to me that I had a few therapists that I was looking at, and she did make the cut. I'm not sure that many therapists help. I mean, because I quit therapy maybe 5 years ago. I just wasn't finding the right therapist, but it definitely makes a difference. It takes time and money and effort,
definitely.
For sure.
So, You said somebody was protecting you. Can you elaborate on who was protecting you?
Well, I'm very spiritual. I was raised in a Christian home, and when my first husband died, I kind of came back to God, but did take a detour. And so when he died, I got back in touch with God, and then when I had to surrender this marriage over to God, that's when I really learned to surrender. And so I am religious. I am spiritual. I know that can be a sticking point for some survivors because I know some people had religion used against them, and I try and be mindful of that. And
Definitely. Were you ever angry at God for this happening? Were you ever
it's interesting.
Your God.
When my husband died, I didn't get angry over that because I experienced such growth and joy, and I could be grateful for that experience because I thank you, God. But I would have discussions with him. I'd be like, okay, thank you for that experience, but sexual abuse, what is that about? Why did that have to happen? I've had angry discussions with God. I've cursed at God. I've screamed at God. I have.
Me too. So, we have to let our feelings out. God's a feeling God, and he knows our feelings, you know, and he can handle whatever we're feeling, right? And, you know, NASCA's a show for all people, not just Christians, you know. So, you know, I'd like to find out, you know, what type of spiritual, you know, if anything spiritual did help anybody. You know, I had a spiritual encounter, and that helped me, but that doesn't mean everybody goes that way. And I just tell the audience, don't tune us out, because if you want to come on the show and tell your story and you're an atheist or whatever you are, we're here for you, and we don't have any kind of...
I have some amazing atheist friends. I'm going to tell you, I have some amazing atheist friends, so... I wouldn't
Absolutely.
Change them.
Okay, and you said that you're reaching out to the media any way you can to bring about awareness to the silent epidemic. I think this is more silent than actual, familial, more silent than, you know, somebody it happened to somebody from on the outside of the family.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Because the family covered up,
right? Yeah, and it's complicated because we care about that family member, you know, so it gets very complicated.
Absolutely.
And sometimes we love that family member.
And also, if we brought it out, they can be charged with a crime, right?
Right.
Your brother would have gone to juvenile detention probably for a while or something, you know?
Right.
So,
yes, he would have.
Yeah, let's talk about you're in a group called Incest Aware. I think I've heard of that group. Can you tell us about it?
Sure. So Suzanne Izaza, she started it. She found me online, and we started connecting, and we just really connected. And she started a network called SAN, Sexual Advocacy Awareness Network, I believe. It's a Facebook group where many, I think you might be in there, Pamela, I'm not sure, where all the advocates come together. And Incest Aware just was kind of born out of that. And I've been very fortunate to become part of the board, and we're just kind of starting to grow because we tried to intertwine with RAIN, and because you go to RAIN's website and sibling sexual abuse and incest, it's not on there. It's buried. RAIN does a lot of great things for assault, but for my people, they're kind of silent. So we actually tried to work with them, but they are pretty corporate. We have not given up, but we decided, fine, then we're just going to start with Incest Aware and go for there. I did not start it, but Suzanne Izaza did, but we're all very, very passionate about it.
That's awesome. Yeah, probably a lot of NAF members are also members of that group. We would like to have more survivors come on and talk about fame and what y'all are doing. You know, like we have topic night on Tuesdays and Thursdays, and a representative from the group could come on and talk about, we could talk about incest as a topic.
Right.
Okay, so now we're going to talk about you working on a memoir and a children's book. You're writing your memoir?
I'm still writing my memoir. It's been a couple of years. I'm almost completed with the first draft. Yeah.
Oh, awesome. And you're also working on a children's book.
I am working on a children's book, and every time I think I'm almost done, then I go back through it and I decide, no, I need to rewrite it again. So definitely both of them are a process. Hoping to have something
by
the fall.
When I was writing my book, I started doing that too, and at some point I had to say, nope, not going to go back through and rewrite anything. It's looking good the way it is. If I want to add something later, I'll add it and do a second edition.
Yeah, I think I'm not there yet, but I think I will.
That'll probably happen at some point.
I'm looking forward to that day.
You're also pitching some possible articles. What kind of articles?
Mm-hmm. Well, I've tried pitching some news media. I've tried pitching some editorial magazines, New York Times, Chicago Tribune. I've tried pitching People Magazine. I've tried pitching USA Today, and they are all silent. They are all ignoring me, but I will keep trying.
Absolutely. That's amazing that you're doing that. But, you know, they're all owned by, I hate to say it, people that condone this stuff, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and
I don't
want to
be out
topic.
Of them.
Well,
no,
and they in fairness to them, they're trying to figure out what do their viewers want to hear and what makes their viewership happy, and sexual abuse does not make viewers happy. So, but I'll keep trying.
Yeah, one day it won't be so taboo to talk about. All right, let's go down the panel one more time. We got 15 minutes left, so I'm going to go down to Mark. Mark, what do you think about about the website and the things that, let's see, we didn't talk about your website yet. ComplicatedCourage.com?
Right. Yeah.
Well,
why don't you
let her share about her website so we can all know about it.
Okay. Go ahead.
I'll be honest. It's really a website. Because when I started writing my story, I Googled sibling sexual abuse, and I couldn't find much on it. And I thought, I know I'm not the only one. So I did start my website. And it's really, you know, my story. If there's nothing new on there that you guys haven't heard this evening. And then some resources, some children's books or some websites for parents and whatnot. It's not really a big deal. I'd call it a placeholder for right now.
Well, that, you know, the beginning, you know, and it builds up and grows. You know, the more that information is made available to the public, you know, the better off, I say.
Right. Right. Great. I'm
but
trying.
Don't
trying.
All right, Mark. Thank you, Doug. Doug, are you still here with us? Doug's listening. Mary Ellen? Mary
Hi.
Ellen?
Yep. I wanted to comment on the fact what you were saying about it's hard to get people interested in incest because it's so taboo. So they don't want to jump right on and, you know, let's share because it rocks the boat, I guess is the way to say it. But it's definitely, I think, one of the most important topics out there today that needs to be pushed and people need to be educated and they need healing happens when people are allowed to share their stories in a safe place. And I can say for myself that my family doesn't want to hear, when I say my family, I'm speaking my siblings and my mom who has passed. They don't want to hear about what my background was, what happened to me, and where I am today in my healing, because then they have to accept that things were different than the way they perceive.
Mm-hmm.
They've got this formed. They don't want that changed. And even though they know it's major taboo, you know, they'll say to me if I'm having a rough time, they know this is where my head is. How are you? But they really don't want to hear the answer. So
right.
I'm very proud of you for stepping forward and moving in the directions that you are. And there are a lot of people that will benefit from it. So thank you so much.
Well, thank you for your support.
You're
and
very
your wisdom.
Aw, thank you.
Thank you for staying with us, Mary Ellen. We've got about 10 minutes left in the show, so we're going to talk now about some nuggets that she's got down here about, you know, how people need to own their story by writing it down and sharing with other survivors. Don't stay in your story. What do you mean by don't stay in your story?
Well, because I kept staying in that negative place, and once This is actually, I'm glad you asked this question, because I learned a lot from my first grief process. I'm going to kind of backtrack a little bit. When my first husband died, I thought, okay, I made it to the first year, I should be good. No. Made it to the second year, okay, I should be good. Third year, no. Fourth year, okay, when is this going to get easier? And then, honestly, the 10-year anniversary was really hard for me of his death, even though I was remarried. And I thought, well, wait a second, you know, maybe there is no finish line to my grief. Maybe that doesn't go away. Maybe I learn how to carry it. And then once I was able to kind of put that in perspective, I thought, huh, maybe there's not a finish line for my healing process. You know, I think I was just trying to do that rat race. You know, when does it get easier? When does this end? Where's that finish line? How can I get through this? And once I thought, wait a second, there's no finish line. It's part of who I am. It's part of my makeup. Then I could own my story and said, this is who I am. This is my story. Take it or leave it. Love me for who I am. This is me. And I think that's what I mean when I say, try not, you know, don't stay in your story. You can own your story. We are the survivors that I know are the most beautiful, most empathetic, amazing, giving human beings. And we own that. We earned that.
You are so right when you say that. It says, own your story with grace. What does that mean? Grace for yourself, mercy for yourself?
I had to forgive that little girl. I actually had a picture of me in the mirror, and I didn't know who she was. I'm like, who are you? What do you want? I want nothing to do with you. You let me down. You didn't tell. You enjoy the abuse.
Yeah.
And I had to forgive her. And I actually have another story about that, if you don't mind. I exercise like crazy because that's part of my coping mechanism and my body image issues. And so I often need massages. So I went to go get a massage, and it's usually with a female, but the female was sick, and they said, we have a male. And I said, well, okay, you know. And I went in, and he asked me the usual questions, and he started the massage, and he pushed the boundaries. And he pushed the boundary once, and I thought, did that happen? And then he pushed the boundary again, and I thought, did that happen? And I was 45 years old, and I froze, and I didn't know what to do. And the session ended, and he went out in the hallway and gets a cup of water, and I get dressed, and I'm thinking, what the hell just happened? I am so embarrassed. And I went out, I grabbed a cup of water, and I went to go pay for the massage, and I said, would you like to book another session? And I said, no. Thinking, do they know? Do they think that I booked him on purpose because I'm seeking some extra attention? And I drove away, and I had to pick up my kids, and it hit me. I thought, wait a second. That wasn't my fault. I was 45 years old, and I still didn't know what to do. I still froze, and I still didn't jump off the table, and I still didn't say anything. So how was that 6-year-old girl going to do anything? And so I was able to forgive that 6-year-old little girl. So that's what I mean by giving yourself that grace, because we judge ourselves from an adult perspective. You know, why didn't that 6-year-old girl do anything? But she was 6. I think that's
right.
That's what I'm trying to say. Give yourself some grace. We were children. We weren't who we are today.
Yeah, you're speaking a lot about my book right now. My book, it's Survivor's Fast Track to Mental Wholeness, and what I talk about in there is grieving the loss of our sexual innocence and our childhood innocence, and we have to grieve that, you know,
we do.
To get healed and to and to integrate with our inner child that was abused. And I'm like you. I thought that child was disgusting and dirty, and I didn't want anything to do with her. But as my healing came into being and I was grieving over that, I was able to receive her. Now she's integrated with me. She's no longer separate. She's me. And it was beautiful. So, So I wanted to say, You do say what I said in my book. I help survivors implement the healing process by understanding it is a grief process, because losing your innocence, your childhood, is the first grief process children face. That children don't have the tools to process the grieving. So what happens is we can't grieve until we're able to understand what grieving is, right?
Right.
Hold it. Right.
Yeah, and that sometimes we don't, even as adults, we don't know what the grief process is, you know? It's because that's another taboo subject. You know, people want you to grieve and get over it, move on.
Right, absolutely. And people don't know how to help people grieve, you know?
No.
And they don't understand. Well, they don't know. The people that are grieving don't understand that there are actual stages, like denial, anger, bargaining, depression, acceptance. And then in my book, I added 3 more stages for sexual abuse, child sexual abuse, closure, striving, and thriving. And so, you know, that's what I did. And I have a master's in social work, and I came up with an actual therapy called Grief Stages Plus Narrative Therapy, where you, like you said here, you rewrite a new ending of your story, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's narrative therapy. So we have 4 minutes left. can you leave the audience with something that you would like them to know?
I think what I'd like the audience to know, if anybody's out there listening and you are a sibling sexual abuse survivor, and if you're questioning whether you're sexually abused or not, I want you to understand that I hear that a lot as well. People do reach out to me because I do have a Facebook page and my website, and I'm a moderator for a group. And I see a lot of confusion about, well, maybe I wasn't sexually abused because it was another child, but that is sexual abuse, and you are not alone. The statistics are high. And I do encourage survivors to start to write your story, even if you just start with 3 minutes a day and take a step back, because it can be painful. Always take self-care. And if you ever feel ready to share your story, sometimes we don't always have to share our stories. Sometimes we don't all have to share our stories. Sometimes you can be an advocate in other ways. But if you feel called to share your story, I've found a lot of healing in that, because then you find others like you. Join a group and find others like you, because that was very healing for me too, because I just didn't understand. I thought, well, did this happen, or do you feel this? And that was really helpful to me.
Absolutely. Survivors, talking to survivors is the best thing in the world. You know, you try to talk to somebody that doesn't understand, you're just going to get rejection, you know, which is the same thing you got when you were young. You know, don't try to tell somebody that doesn't understand, because that's just going to backfire on you. Survivors need to be with survivors, right? Need to be supported.
I would agree. I don't want somebody to tell me, think positive, look at the bright side. The trauma brain doesn't react that way.
Yeah. All right. So we have a minute left. I want to read this last statement you said, because it is so powerful. Someone in the world needs to hear your story, because courage is, I love that. Courage is contagious. So we're going to end the NASCA show tonight with Jane Epstein, who's been our guest. Thank our panelists, Doug, Mary Ellen, and our other panelists that have since dropped off because they had something else to do. And I'm going to say to the NASCA family that we're all in this together. We all love each other and are there for each other. And from NASCA, let's protect our children. If you see something, say something. Good night.
Love Talk Radio.